Bernie Moreno is looking out for himself, not us. Moreno is totally out of touch, and his company has a history of discriminating against its own workers. Moreno has even faced multiple lawsuits for racial discrimination. One black man sued for being told, "You black men out there tried to hide your criminal records," and being passed over for less qualified white applicants. Moreno has shown his colors. If he's elected senator, he's liable to rubber stamp Trump's radical Project 2025 agenda 100% and turn back the clock for Ohio. From taking away our overtime pay to gutting our public schools and rolling back our civil rights, we can't let Moreno take us backwards. We can count on Sherrod Brown to continue doing what's right to protect Ohio's workers and families. Vote and re-elect Sherrod Brown.
Paid for by Ask Me People, AskMePeople.org, which is responsible for the content of this ad. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
You're listening to a Count Out Podcast.
What it is, what's up, and welcome everyone to Faces and Feels. I'm your host, Rafe Hewson, and today I'm joined by a very special guest. I never thought I'd get to speak to this man, but it has happened, and I am very, very grateful for his time. It's the one and only Ricky Shane Page, RSP. How are you today, my man?
I'm doing great. Very, very, very great. I'm glad that we can make this happen.
Me too, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. How's it feel a little bit before we get into kind of my usual thing? Like we were chatting a little bit off mic, and there was a certain time in the independence when I would say that you're responsible in a lot of ways for like the resurgence of deathmatch, and it was definitely, you played a huge part in my interest in American deathmatch. How is it like living that? Because there was a time when I honestly believe you were the only true heel in wrestling, right? Like you were like the only dude where I was like, I wouldn't even speak to him, like because I'm too afraid of him kind of deal. How is it like committing to that? Because that's not like a thing that like a lot of people can do these days, you know?
It was very easy for me, to be honest. I'm kind of a private person.
Sure.
And, what we were talking earlier, I really value my time.
Yeah.
So it was just an excuse for me to not have to
promote, do social media, play nice.
Yeah. And when I did, like when people just bit on every word or whatever, because I was so few and far between when I did it.
Yeah.
It was funny, like we'd be at the merch table, and like one of the other 440 boys would come up to me and be like, "Hey, will you sign this? Or will you go take a picture with this person? Like, they're too afraid to come ask you." And I was like, I'd sit there and talk to him for a second and like make him wait, and then I'd be like, "Yeah, that's fine. Tell him to come over here." And I was like, it's like no one spoke to me directly.
That's so funny. Yeah, well, I mean, that's how I felt about it. You know what I mean? Like you kind of put on this real aura where it really felt like it would, even though, you know, like I'd heard interviews and stuff, I'm like, I know this guy clearly isn't like a prick in real life, you know, and I've seen your other stuff, but like you created this amazing wall where it's like, it felt like it was breaking the rules to even go through it. You know what I mean? And I just really appreciate it. I thought it was amazing.
Thank you. I can be a prick. And I think I just kind of let that side of me mm-hmm. out. And, you know, it was weird too. Cause like, and a lot of times unbeknownst to us, it was happening in the locker rooms as well. Like some wrestlers felt the same way.
Yeah. Right.
Which we didn't know about. So, which was quite funny.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was weird, man. But I think that the reason it worked is because nobody cares anymore, and I feel like no one really tried, especially then.
Yeah.
And like, I just tried really hard and I cared so much.
Yeah.
And I just stuck to it. I committed to it. It was awkward sometimes and weird. And also I don't think, you know, this is not really well known, but like, I was only ever a heel like one other time.
Yeah. Right.
In my whole career, I was always a babyface. Always.
Yeah.
So a lot of that stuff was just me learning. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was a wild time.
It sure was. And I'm sure we'll walk down that a little bit more. I just wanted to touch on that real quick to even start, you know, because it really was special. And I haven't seen anybody do anything like it since, you know. And, yeah, it was just crazy and seeing, like, the fan reactions. And even in that time, like in the world, because it was around that kind of iffy COVID time and things like that, and you guys had to navigate through all that. And it was just, yeah, a masterclass in a lot of ways, like in how to do that stuff, you know, on the indies. But we'll rewind first up. I always ask people, you know, when they think back how they got into professional wrestling, what were some of the wrestlers, the faces of wrestlers that stood out to them when they got into it? Who were some of your favorites and really, you know, drew you into it?
I think, you know, Hogan mm-hmm. was, you know, because I'm an 80s kid. I was born in 84.
Sure.
So, you know, late 80s, early 90s. Hulkamania was running wild, brother.
Literally.
And, so everybody was watching wrestling. And I remember in like 91, maybe, I distinctly remember the Undertaker and Ultimate Warrior
yes.
feud where he put him in that casket and then smashed it up with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
I just remember those two specifically. And then he came back, or like before that, there was like something with Jake the Snake, or he's in like a room full of snakes mm-hmm. or something. I remember all those very vividly because I remember it being like so kind of like ridiculous and then also cool that yeah. these guys were doing this stuff. Yeah. And I remember a story my dad told me. I guess I was very young. He was watching like NWA one time mm-hmm. and a bunch of people were like beating up Dusty Rhodes. And I guess I just went, shit.
Your first like, recorded like, curse word.
Yeah, because the American Dream got beat up. But yeah, so yeah, that's kind of, you know, that era of wrestling was, you know, so popular and stuff. So it was like everybody watched it. So it was just, you know, it's such a big part of pop culture at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first got into wrestling, I'm also like an ace kid, I'm 82. And when I first got into it, I was in Australia, so it's not on TV, right? Like, I traded a magazine with a kid. I traded, what did I give him, like a paint pen or something like that, and I got like a WWF magazine, right? Hogan on the yeah. cover, whatever, and I'm like, what is this? And big fold-out of Ultimate Warrior, and I'm like, this shit's cool. And I started like renting the VHS tapes from Blockbuster or whatever it was, and they always used to start, like you'd see Hulk Hogan or his video and stuff, and you'd see him like pull up in a motorcycle and all the kids and stuff would like run yeah. to him. And I always like to ask like American people, I'm like, was that what it was like? You know, like were you guys feeling that like as kids? You were like, oh, that could be me or that was me or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there was just like these like larger than life crazy characters and, mm-hmm. you know, they were superheroes. You know, like I always thought, like, because my dad had a mustache, that my dad looked like Hulk Hogan.
Oh, there you go.
And
did he have the handlebars?
He just had like that always. He just would have a mustache, like a big one. And it just reminded me
hell yeah.
of Hulk Hogan. And I'd always be like, oh, my dad's awesome because he looks like Hulk Hogan. So, like, that was our Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
You know, our Bluey, or if you will.
Exactly. You guys obviously would have had that cartoon. Like, was it Rock and Roll Wrestling or whatever? Like, I used to love that. Sure. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, we had that. Then we had the Super Mario Brothers show that Captain Little Banner was on and stuff like wrestling was in everything.
Yeah, which it's just so crazy because it's like my entire life something I had to seek out and like this, you know, hidden side thing. But for you guys, it was just like everywhere and mainstream and like patriotic and all those things.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, it's, I think a lot of the times people forget that it's an American sport.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like we created it. So it's like ingrained in our culture.
Yeah.
And you know, not in a great way. I don't think all of the country feels that way about wrestling,
sure.
But it really is like ingrained in the culture of America. And I don't know. It's just like, even if you hate wrestling, you know about it.
Yeah, Well, absolutely. You can't not know about it. There's, you know, there's so many wrestlers who have gone on to become, you know, movie stars and things like that that are household names. You know, they may be the only names that people know, but they know them.
Yeah,
exactly. Sure. Where it's like you could probably argue there's plenty of very amazing like sports stars and Olympians that nobody knows the name of.
I don't know who plays first base for the Yankees.
No, I don't know a single Yankee player. Exactly, but no, I can tell you.
Yeah, who knows?
Exactly.
I can tell you who's on Heat Wave 99.
Exactly right. We can narrow that down. So how do you then, like, so you're growing up, all that stuff has gone on. Do you then, is that you hooked from a very young age? Are you going into your teens and stuff, like you're wearing Jeff Hardy sleeves and cargos? Like, what are we doing? Like, how's the level?
So I got out of it. Yeah. Like, I feel like a lot of people did, yeah. You know, in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
You know, like 93, 4, 5, you know, the era that everyone talks about was the downtime of WWF and stuff, and even WCW at the time. So I just didn't watch it. And then, you know, around 96, 97, the Attitude Era started picking up. I think I started watching WCW first because of NWO and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it just snowballed from there into Austin, watching WWF and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I picked back up on everything. Mm-hmm. And then I got obsessed.
Yeah.
And
I can relate.
I watched King of the Ring 1998.
Yeah.
And Mick Foley got thrown off the cage at Hell in a Cell. And I just remember thinking, like mid-air before he hit the table, like, oh, like I'm going to be a wrestler someday. And
I want to be that guy, the guy plummeting to his death.
I mean, if you could look back at my career at all, you would see that there. But it was a very heavy influence from
there's been a few moments like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that, and then, you know, a year later, I started backyard wrestling. 2 years later, I started getting on indie shows, and then, you know, the rest is history.
Absolutely. How did, I think in a lot of ways, like if I was a wrestler, considering like the ages that we were at, I would have absolutely approached it like you did. Because when I think about your indie character and like that kind of like Spawn mask and things like that, I'm like, hell yeah, brother, let's go. How did you start backyarding, like right from the beginning? So you're into that, I guess some other friends are, and you're like, let's kick the shit out of each other. Like, what are we doing?
I just remember after I watched King of the Ring, I was like, I want to wrestle. I want to figure this out. And at that time, backyard wrestling was like huge. They were like, I don't know if you guys had the best of backyard wrestling tapes.
I know what they are, but I've never seen them all. No. Mm-hmm.
So there was commercials on TV about these.
Really?
That you could order. Yeah. And like backyard wrestling, and it was on like, you know, backyard wrestling was on like Ricky Lake and Jerry Springer and like,
that's right, blah, blah, wasn't there a video game and shit as well, like Matt Cross was on it and stuff, like,
yeah, that was later though, that was like 2003 maybe.
Yeah, okay.
So like it was just like a big thing. So a friend of mine had knew another kid that used to do it. Mm-hmm. But he didn't have any that he used to do it with, didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
So then I met him, we started doing it, and then I went to this one high school in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I just got all the kids that I went to high school with to do it. And just snowballed from there.
Absolutely. What was your setup like? I love talk about the janky backyard setups, because I've talked about people making a few of their own rings and things like that. Like, did you guys have access to something?
I ran the gamut, because I backyard wrestled for a very long time, like well into my indie career.
Yeah, right.
Because there was like this huge community of backyard wrestlers on this message board. And anyways, I used to go and I wrestle all the time. So back then it was my dad's mattress from his bed, because he was, you know, working.
Yeah.
And I'd throw that out on the yard, try to do like two mats and whatever mats or mattresses I could find. And then we'd always do like, we'd have two ladders, and we had like this like very makeshift painter's scaffolding between the two ladders. And that was the top rope. And then, you know, whatever else junk I could find in a garbage dump somewhere that we could break. And then that evolved into a friend of mine that lived about 30 minutes away. I've met through this. He had this really nice homemade ring in his house. So we started going wrestling there. And we just, wherever we could, man. I wanted to wrestle so bad that I did it however I could.
Yeah. Just get in where you fit in kind of thing. What's going on? Practicing it.
Yeah.
So just I, like I, really self-taught then, like right from the start.
A little bit. Like I kind of had some of the bigger stuff down first, which is not good. It's like building the house and building the walls first and then building the basement.
Yeah.
It's a bit hard to hold all those walls up while you're trying to, you know, fix that foundation. So it was rough for me at first, but I just picked up, I loved it. I watched it obsessively. I was obsessed. So, once I started training and things like that, like I even had a trouble with that. I started training, the school closed down. So I ended up wrestling for the company that had the school. They reopened the school like a year later. And then I went back and I was there like 4 or 5 days a week for like a year straight.
Yeah. Right.
But I had already been wrestling for like 3 years at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And what age were you when you started? Like
17.
Yeah. Right. So it was really like 19, 20 before like the school was really up and rocking and you could go all the time.
Yeah, 19, 20 is when I started, like 2003, 2004.
Sure.
Probably 2004, actually. Around that time, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a slow build for me.
Yeah, and then
I used to not count those years either.
Oh, really?
I used to be like, oh. Yeah, because, like, you know, there's always this weird stigma about wrestling not trained and all that. And it's just like, but then as I got older and, you know, actually did things in the business, I started thinking like, oh, those people who said that were a bunch of idiots who never left our hometown. Like,
yeah,
screw them. Like, I was bumping.
Absolutely. You're doing like on the job training essentially. And it's also all the micro things, right? Like you're in front of crowds. And so you're learning how to, you know, feed off them and react to things and the little kind of stuff that you learn while people are laughing at you or fucking, you know, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like it all adds up.
So yeah, a bit self-taught, but I will say that my trainer taught me the finer points and shaped who I am as a wrestler, and I still keep those traits to this day.
Yeah, that's great. Did you find it like a big change, like when you were suddenly like in a ring and had access to that kind of stuff? Like, did you find you were like, oh, I immediately sort of know how to do this, or was there a bit of a transition? Like, man, I've got to really fucking rethink how I do this. You know,
nah. I never thought about it until recently.
Yeah.
There was just like, there was nothing I wouldn't do.
Yeah.
And I remember that first time I got in an actual ring and like was bumping around, like not being taught the right way. I was just trying to figure it out. And I remember being in such pain the next day, like just absolutely battered but I just didn't care. And I was ready to go again the next day, even though I had to wait a week, you know? And then even after that, like I used to drive an hour. I would set up the ring. We would train. We would take the ring down, put it back over in this little storage area. And I would drive home. I did it every week for like a year.
Wow.
Just so I could wrestle. So there was just like, I don't know. It's so cliche to say like, oh, I was born to do this and that, but like, it's the only thing that I have ever been really good at, and it just feels like I should be doing. So
yeah,
it's weird.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a career behind you now. So I think it's safe to say you've made your living doing it, and you've like been, you know, successful, and you've drawn money and done those things. So, and I mean, it's helped you travel and stuff. So there's no lies there. You know what I mean? Like that's real.
Yeah.
And I can relate to doing that stupid shit. Like, I mean, I'm not actively doing it anymore, but I was in like a band for a long time. Me and my mates had a metal band. I started, I got to move to the city because I used to live in the country town and started at university. And so I started playing bass guitar and we decided we were going to form a band. We went and did that shit for 10 years and we would do all that stuff, load up all this shit, drive to some bullshit gig in the middle of fucking nowhere and play to 10 people and do all this stuff and spend your money and do that. And people are like, why the fuck are you doing that? It's like, because I want to fucking play. Like, I want to do this and meet people, and you only can gain experience and fans by showing people, you know?
You can never explain it to someone.
No, unless they've lived it, right? Like,
yeah. It's just, you know, why do you, it's the same thing. I hear comedians tell the same exact stories, you know? It's just a civilian, as I like to call them. They'll just never understand. And you know, a bit of a tip out there to young wrestlers. don't get mad at your significant other when they don't get it.
Yeah.
Because unless they do it, they ain't never going to get it. Just try to explain it to them as much as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely had those things like in relationships, like, you know, and even with my now wife, I remember having like dust ups and stuff, like her coming to visit us on tour and we've been doing things or whatever. And just like, I'm fucking here. I'm like, I'm chasing it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to. Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm trying to chase my fucking dream is what I'm doing. Like, and obviously I'm a band in Australia and it became what it did, but I managed to, over that 10 years, have no regrets about what that was because exactly. Like, and you know, we released albums, we toured with my favorite bands, we did all these things. And I'm like, you know what? Now we're at a stage in our life. People have got different opportunities. We're going to do it. We're all friends. We're just going to call it. And I don't look back at that like that was a wasted decade of my life. I'm like, I fucking gave it a go, you know, like, and it then informed everything else I did with this or with my career. I work in, you know, guitar sales and things like that. Like, it's just sort of formed my entire life. Whereas if you'd spoken to me before I first picked up that bass guitar, that's a different fucking person. And anybody that went to school with me would tell you that. Like, they were like, I have people message me like, what do you mean you're in this band? Who the fuck are you, kind of thing? And it was probably the same for you, right? People knew you and this thing, and then you went and you chased this thing, and then there's probably people that went to school with you like, who the fuck is this dude? Like, you know, it's the same thing.
If they remember me from school, I was barely there. I always get the, you still doing that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, man, still doing it.
Yeah.
And because, you know, you don't realize how much of a bubble you're in, you know. Yeah. Like, maybe in some circles I'm like, you know, Z-list famous.
Yeah.
But my uncle don't know that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He don't give a shit if I went to Japan.
Yeah. Doesn't care that somebody, like, you know, paid for you to tour in this thing that you're a fucking deathmatch legend that you fucking carried indie wrestling for, like, none of that means anything to them. They're like, but what are you doing for a job? Like, you know, that kind of.
Like, where are you coming over for a 4th of July barbecue? Like, they don't care, you know? Mm-hmm. I think they think like, oh, he does some kind of wrestling, or they might think it's cool. Maybe they know more about it and I don't know, but like, it's such a very small world.
Yeah.
So it's funny.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the niche of the niche in a lot of ways, which is why it's crazy when you get fucking rock star attitudes and bullshit politics within this stuff. Cause it's like, brother, like, you know what this is, right?
Yeah, man. I don't think people understand.
They do not. Well, continuing your journey. So you cruise through all that stuff. We do the backyard stuff. We're sucking in actual training. Let's talk about that. Look, I briefly mentioned it, but sort of like the faith and nothing stuff. And to as best as I can tell from somebody that wasn't there or is on the other side of the world, that was kind of when you started to gain a little bit of steam, right? Like, because you guys were doing like a lot as that tag team, yeah?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So yeah, like, the training was hard, but I loved it, and I just stuck with it. And then that got me opportunities within my area. With I was at training at Mega Championship Wrestling, which they still run shows to this day.
Mm-hmm.
They literally had a show last Saturday, and then that afforded me opportunities with Cleveland All Pro Wrestling, which was ran by JT Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the first like little like indie place that I was wrestling at, the second one that I did was ran by my tag team partner, Vincent Nothing.
Mm.
And that's how I met him. So when I went, he ended up going to college at Ohio State University. And he would come up and train every once in a while as much as he could because it was hard because it's a bit far.
Yeah.
So that just, again, I just trained and got into those places. And then myself, Vince, and another friend of mine, we would travel with each other all the time. And we started our own booking website. It was called nonamebookings.com. Mm-hmm. And somehow my friend who I started Backyard Wrestling with,
mm-hmm.
that was a friend of my other friend.
Yeah.
He started this website, and somehow he knew like Kimona Wanalea and Christy Mist somehow.
Okay.
So they were on this website.
Uh-huh.
And so were me, Vince and Nothing, and my friend.
And that was the only people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when we got booked, we'd be like, oh, you have to go through the website. And but it was just my friend, Josh. Like,
yeah, yeah. It's like, hi, Roland, we've got management. You've got to go through the, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, but like it worked.
Yeah.
So like we got a couple bookings off of it. I remember a couple wrestlers asking us about how to get on there. And we were like, oh, you got to email them, dude. I don't know. They came to us.
Total work. Yeah, yeah.
We were just fucking, I don't know. We were idiots. But anyways, so as one of the options on the booking site was that you could pair any one of us three as a tag team. Mm-hmm. So we were just like taking pictures of each pairing. And then I was like, well, me and Vince were doing it. And we were like, well, what should our tag name be? Because we always wrestled each other. Uh-huh. We would go around local stuff in Ohio and wrestle each other all the time. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I was like, I don't have a name. And then my friend's girlfriend was like, oh, you should be Faith and Nothing. And we were like, that's awesome. I'd be like, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So we put it on the website, and even though we had never tagged. and then around that same time, we got booked for Cleveland All-Pro as a team. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2005. Mm-hmm. And because we wrestled each other so much that we just had like a natural chemistry and timing and stuff. Mm-hmm. And JT Lightning, you know, really gave us a push as tag team there. And he put us against a lot of good people and really helped us get to the next level, which made us be able to travel all over, like you said, and you know, seeing a lot of Faith and Nothing. Ever, we were all up and down the Midwest doing all sorts of stuff. We were really on the verge of breaking out. It just never quite happened. Vince retired, and then I had a neck injury at the time, so all of our momentum kind of stopped.
Yeah, that sucks. Was it any like surgery or anything like that, or it was just a bit busted up and you had to re?
It was supposedly going to be surgery and like spinal cord surgery.
Oh Jesus!
But yeah, so I ended up being able to fix it with physical therapy, like intense physical therapy for like 6 months. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just my neck. It was like a bunch of other things too that was like impeding the neck. Like my ribs were messed up. My shoulders were messed up. Like I had to like – I was in like physical therapy for 3 times a week for 6 months to correct everything. I didn't wrestle for like – 10 months, 11 months.
Yeah, so, wow.
Right before that, I was like, I couldn't lift anything over 5 pounds. My whole entire left hand was numb and very weak. I was having like, I don't think it was atrophy, but there was just like this impinged nerve was just like making me lose all the strength in my arm.
Sure.
So yeah, I had to take a long time out. And that was 16 years ago.
Wow. I'm sure that was scary as well. Like anytime, like any injury like sucks, but when you're talking about neck stuff and hands and losing power and things like that, that's a pretty harrowing sort of thing to go through. And especially something that prevents you from doing the thing that you love to do. That absolutely sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a brutal 10 months.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And then when I came back is when I lost the mask and I basically had to start over.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing 2-3 hour drives to Pittsburgh for $10.
Yeah.
At 10 years in the business, you know. So,
just total reset.
I don't think a lot of kids realize that either. Like, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do just to stay around.
Yeah.
And you got to eat some shit every once in a while. And you can't ever be above that.
Yeah.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was rough.
Absolutely. Because I mean, you're talking that break, like it's out of sight, out of mind, right? And there's new fans and there's new things and there's new wrestlers at the thing. It's like people don't know who the fuck you are, you know? And especially if you're going to change like the gimmick and stuff. I mean, that band I was talking about, we're about to play this Saturday for the first time in like 7 years, right? And then that 7 years ago, we'd done a reunion 7 years before that. So we're about to play now. And there was a time when we were like the fucking dudes here. I'm like, nobody at this show knows who the fuck we are. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're playing on this festival. Yeah. And I'm like, all the young bands and things like that, they don't know. They're going to know. But like, they don't know. And so all you can do is like put in that work and show them again, you know?
Yeah, I love when that stuff happens now. Mm-hmm. Happened to me like maybe a year ago. Mm-hmm. I was wrestling in Erie, Pennsylvania for pro wrestling. Mm-hmm. God, I'm going to forget the name. it just changed the name to something else, and now I can't remember. Anyways, there's a wrestling company. It's ran by John McChesney. I can't remember what. I think it's called Big League Wrestling now, but it was called something else before.
Sure.
Anyways, Erie, Pennsylvania is only like an hour and a half from me, 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I drove, went there, and it was 600 people, that big old crowd. I was like, man, this is great. This is going to be cool. Came out. Zero people knew who I fucking was.
Just no reaction.
Zero.
Crickets.
Zero reaction. Like, yeah. Nothing. No, not one way or the other. And I came out and I was just like, oh, all right, here we go. So, dude, I wrestled, came out, and he had a manager. And I said, oh, okay, don't worry, I got it. So we started wrestling. I did a little thing, you know, did an arm drag or something. I slid right out of the ring, right to her. And I was like, hey, what's your Instagram? And then the crowd, boom, just turned right away.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, cool, got him.
Yeah.
Like, now we can proceed. And, you know, I'm famous or what? I'm not.
Yeah.
You know.
It's an hour and a half again, away.
Yeah, exactly. And at a wrestling show, an independent wrestling show.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the type of fans they draw and things like that, you know, like in their local community.
Just, yeah, wrestlers, think about your bubble, man. Yeah. Like, that's all I'm saying. Like, everybody, like, they just... The world's a big place, man.
Yeah, it really is. Sometimes it's a very small place, but also it really is very big. Do you think there's a part of you? Well, I mean, there would be. I saw you telling that story, and you were kind of liking, like, oh, okay, there's nobody here. Let's see what I can do to make this happen. I a friend once told me, he's now a fucking psychologist or something now, but he told me, he was like, human beings are like a piece of coal, right? And our whole thing is we want to get shined up and we want to be a diamond. We want to go into the rock tumbler and we want to get fucking shined up and become our best self. And sometimes you get to a certain point where you're just like, you know what, fuck it. I'm going back in the tumbler again. I just need to fucking reshine myself up and just go through it. And that reset can be really fun sometimes where you're like, I'm back to number one. Let's see if I can just do it again and like go.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of doing that right now.
Yeah.
A little bit. Like, cause I'm always, so when I'm doing something, I'm doing it and I do it as much and I try as hard as I can. And then when I have downtime because that ended, I'm like, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
And I got to stay like that. Cause that's how you stay relevant in the business. Mm-hmm. That's how a deathmatch wrestler from Sandusky, Ohio is, that anybody knows who he is, because I don't stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you just have to keep going.
Yeah, exactly. Figure it out. I mean, even some of the top guys in the world, like you look at Chris Jericho, he's always doing new gimmicks, and he doesn't need to. He's kind of going through that, like trying to get this high guys thing over now. It's like he didn't need to do that, but he likes doing that, and that's what's kept him, you know, relevant and interesting.
That's the thing, though. That's why he who he is, because he does do that. Same thing with Matt Hardy, you know. Like, same deal. Like, all these guys, just they evolve, and they are still around.
Yeah.
And I've always kept my eye on that, and I always have a lot of creative ideas, so I'm always up for a change and up for trying something new. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with my childhood as well. I moved a lot, so I'm just an adventurous person.
Yeah.
So, it's I think I was, like I said earlier, like, sometimes I think I'm just I was born to be a wrestler.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I mean, you talk about moving in new locations. Like, you're always reinventing yourself. You go to a new school, great, I go make new friends. I go be thinking, I can be anybody I want here. You know what I mean? So you can just, like, figure it out. Yeah. So how did the transition then, so you're reinventing yourself, you start from scratch. How did the transition then go into, like, more deathmatch stuff? Because Cleveland All-Pro wasn't really that, right? Like, so...
So funny. I was doing the deathmatch stuff back early.
Oh, okay. So right from the beginning, basically.
Oh, yeah. Right off the rip. I was doing tubes and barbed wire and all that stuff.
Oh, okay.
I was 16.
Jesus Christ.
The first match my first match was Christian Faith ever. I was 17 in Cleveland, Ohio, in front of like 400 people. I lied to Vincent Nothing and told him I was 18. And, I did a gauntlet match where I wrestled three people in a row, and they were all death matches.
Jesus.
So my first matches were death matches.
And was that just, you were like a huge fan, you'd done the tape trading, things like that, and you're like, hell yeah, I want to do this. Like, was that harrowing, or you couldn't wait kind of?
No, yeah, I wish I could have had enough money to get the tapes. My friend was just had the internet before anyone,
yeah,
somehow, and knew what Napster was and knew what Kazaa was and, you know, Lime. He just knew what all that stuff was and just
heard like, these words in so long.
Yeah, he found like a German website in like 1999 that made music videos of CZW matches.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's just like one of those dudes. So yeah. I just watched everything.
Yeah.
And I remember I found the CZW website in like 1999 mm-hmm. At my school's computer. They had these old, remember those old Macs that were like a blue and, you know.
Yeah,
those
just bright colors. Yeah.
Yeah, and that I was on CZW's website and I saw Nick Gage and I was like, oh, this looks cool. And then I told my friend about it. He found that German website. We started downloading Deathmatch stuff. And then I was like, I'm going to probably do this.
Hell yeah. Pop him. Nobody else knows what the fuck's going on. Like, and you guys are just in there fucking wasting each other.
Yep.
Yeah. So you're doing the reinvention, the mask has come off and things like that. Are you taking deathmatch bookings at that point? Have you, like, are you starting to make your way into CZW, into things like that? So,
I mean, honestly, like, deathmatches were not looked at how they are now.
No, they weren't cool. Like, you helped to make them cool, but they were not for a long time.
I was shunned.
Yeah.
I was shunned for this. Like, I was ridiculed in the locker rooms. I was made
looked down on you, just like the guy. Yeah,
100%. Like, and so it's not like there wasn't that many out there. Like, and I wasn't, you know, in the business enough or well known or good enough to be like I did be Mid South or CZW at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just a kid, so there was just nowhere to go. So I just there was never anything. So what would happen was there'd be like, I'd be wrestling at like a place around here and there'd be some sort of blow off. And I'd be like, well, like I'll do leg tubes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or like, there'd be like a fans bring the weapons match and they'd bring a bunch of glass and no one would do it. And I'm like, I'll fucking do it. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know? And then actually, I did Carnage Cup 2009.
Okay.
In Alabama for IWA Deep South. Mm-hmm. And I met Danny Havoc. Mm-hmm. And we wrestled. And for 5 years, mm-hmm. Danny Havoc booked DJ Hyde to book me at CZW.
Really? Took that long to get you in?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just my first match at CZW, I had a tag match once a long time ago. That I don't count that because it was like through another promoter. My first match at CZW that I consider my first match was against Danny Havoc at TOD in 2014.
Yeah, wow.
Or 2015.
Yeah.
And
at that stage, you've been wrestling for like 15 plus years.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was another thing, is like I bursted onto the scene, and I guess at CZW, and everybody's like, oh, who's this new guy? And I'm like,
brother.
Yeah. And then I would say I was Christian Faith, and they'd be like, I know who you are. Like, I didn't know that was you. And I was like, I know I wore a mask, but like, I'm like 6'4 and like 300 pounds. And like, you would, there's a bunch of other 6'4, 300 pound dudes on the indies. Right now. So that was like a thing that I had to go through. But I would say that match I had with Danny Havoc at Carnage Cup really like helped me. And like, and he was so kind and literally bugged the hell out of DJ Hyde until he finally let me do it. And then I got there and if it wasn't for Grant, I wouldn't have done what I did. He put me over so much and made sure that I had good matches and I looked good. And he would go out of his way to put himself in harm's way for me. So I'll never forget that.
Yeah. That's just the story that you hear about him over and over from everybody, right? Like, just the kindest dude, so creative, so talented, undervalued himself, but always like really valued everybody else. Like, just, I've spoken to so many people that knew him and thought of him in that way, you know?
He's the best.
No, that's okay. We don't need to dwell on it, but yeah, I think it's just nice to, you know, touch on him, obviously, because he was so special to so many people in the scene. But yeah, I hope he's resting in peace.
from there, you've hit CZW now. How does that feel for, like, you're a kid and you're downloading these videos and stuff, and then now you're here. It took a long time, and you're probably also starting to get a little bit pissed off because Grant's having to work so hard to even get you in the fucking door, and you're like, now I'm going to prove myself. How's it feel when you're actually, like, there and part of the roster? That must feel pretty amazing, like being in a TOD and stuff.
It was great, but I even had to fight for all that. That was another thing. Like, even after I was there, it was like I'd get used every once in a while, and it would be this and that, and just like, and then the whole roster was kind of getting on management. I don't know what was going on internally that time, you know, or if someone there had an issue with how popular I was getting. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I fought and scratched everything I had, even winning the belt.
Yeah.
Wasn't supposed to win the belt. I did. It got a huge I was supposed to lose it the next show.
Yeah. How did it come about that you did win it? Was there some politicking? You going to business for yourself? What did you do?
No. I did go into business for myself a few shows before that.
Okay.
And I got on the microphone and just kind of aired my grievances.
Yeah.
And I pledged that I was going to be the CZW World Champion.
Do it on camera. They can't stop it.
Yeah, no one told me to do that. But I was sick of it. I was sick of everybody telling me how good I was doing and how over I was. And it just wasn't. There was a lot of internal changes going on at the time. I do know that. I will say, when I won the belt, there was another booker.
Yeah.
And they were very smart. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sammy Callahan. And he saw what was going on and just was like, oh, let's put the belt on Ricky for a month and see what happens.
Yeah.
Like, we can do that. That's
was it that kind of vibe where, and I've seen shows like this before, where it becomes so obvious on the show, it's like, this is the next dude. Everybody knows it. All the fans know it. All the fans want to see it. But due to whatever's going on back then, nobody wanted to pull the trigger. And he's like, it seems very obvious to me that everybody wants the trigger pulled on this. Let's just let it rock.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit. It happened with me. It happened with Mance Warner at multiple places. Like, it's a thing that happens because people don't know how to book. honestly.
They let themselves get in the way of, like, actual reading
what
the audience wants. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Sammy saw that and was like, all right, well, it was like the November of it was the show before Cage of Death.
Yeah.
And they know that I was crazy and I will do Cage of Death and go nuts. So Sammy was like, all right, like, we'll have him win and then he'll lose in December.
Yeah. Yeah. Who did you beat for?
Joe Gacy.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you in the position of remembering.
Yeah, Joe Gacy, I'm pretty sure. Yes, cool. It was Joe Gacy. Mm-hmm. And then it was me, Shane Strickland, Joe Gacy, and a three-way at Cage of Death the next month, where I was supposed to lose the belt. Mm-hmm. But because it got such a good reaction on the internet and live at the show, I kept the belt for 6 months.
There you go. That's awesome.
And I lost it at Best of the Best to MJF. So that's a pretty good run.
That is a pretty good run, and you're talking about some of the biggest stars in wrestling at the moment.
I wrestled Ethan Page during that time. I had a good run, and that was all because I just wouldn't stop.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't let anybody, I don't care who it is, get in my way.
Yeah. How was it then when you went to Japan? I remember I was now sort of actively following Deathmatch when you went to Japan. I remember seeing it online and Instagram and things like that, and you and Drew and stuff. Was that approach to you? Like, they obviously wanted to bring you into Big Japan for a while. You were there for a little while, I feel like or doing a bunch of runs.
I did 5 tours in Big Japan.
Yeah, sure.
I guess four and a half. So the first one was there was a British company called Fight Club Pro.
Uh-huh. I remember.
They did some death matches and things like that over in Wolverhampton in the Midlands in the UK. And they were running a show in Japan. And Meiko Satomura was helping them do that. And she was working with Fight Club over there. And they decided to take me.
Mm. Sweet.
So I went, and then we did a joint shows with Big Japan leading up to the Fight Club show that was at Corkin Hall. Mm-hmm. And they really liked me, and they brought me back 4 more times that year.
Nice. Now, was Drew already with Big Japan at that point, or did he come with you from Fight?
Drew was with me with Fight. I was in Drew's first match in Japan.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for Big Japan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I left. I came back. He went back home. I came back, did another tour. And then I think by like my third tour, like a few months later, Drew was like living in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because he was on a lot of those, the last couple of BJW tours I did, he was there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. How did you find Japan? Because it's somewhere that I've been to a lot of times, like just as a tourist, you know, it's something my wife and I like to do. We plan our own trips and we've kind of, I don't want to say we've been everywhere, but we've been a lot of places. How was that? You know, culture shock for you, A, going to an amazing place that is Japan, but then also wrestling there and feeling like, do these people even know me, et cetera. You know?
Yeah. Even before I got into wrestling as a kid, I was just like obsessed with Japan for some reason. Mm-hmm.
Probably the Ninja Turtles and stuff like that.
Maybe Ninja Turtles.
We grew up in the 80s. It was all kung fu movies. It was all,
you know. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows? So I remember that always. And then when I got into watching deathmatch stuff, I always watched the Japanese stuff. And it's when I got into indie wrestling, I watched a lot of Japanese stuff. So like all along the times when you're doing the deathmatch stuff, I'm also watching like Ring of Honor and like Samoa Joe and Christopher Daniels. And like, I'm like such a dual wrestler. Like I love all of that stuff.
Sure.
Especially from that era. Mm-hmm. So wait, what were we talking about?
Japan.
That's right. I was obsessed with it, and I always wanted to go there. Uh-huh. And so when I got there, I was just so excited. It was not that much of a culture shock for me because I'm not a loud, obnoxious American.
This is a fair comment.
People from America don't know that we have that stereotype.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't even call a stereotype. So I think that transition was a bit easier for me. Same reason why when I go to the UK, I think I'm just quiet. I'm just quiet.
You follow the social cues, you do those things because let's face it, and this isn't shade anybody, I have definitely been, you know, in Japan and in areas or in restaurants and seen the stereotype that you're speaking about going down, and it's like, yo, man, can you just shut the fuck up? Like, and it's like, can I get a water and like all this stuff? And it's just like, hey, wait for your turn. They're going to come around. They're going to do that. Like, read how this society works. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But they'd just be like, you know, and you're like, dude, this isn't. Yeah. And you're like, and don't get me wrong. Those people are here, Australians as well. And I fucking see them and I'm like, don't make eye contact with another Australian in the country. But it's like, they're such a polite society that it's like, read it and respect it and follow the cues and you're going to have like an amazing time, you know?
It's the best. Like, I love their culture. I love the way they are reserved and respectful of everyone, no matter what, you know, they will not like you.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, as you know, in their beliefs, but will still treat you with the utmost respect.
Yeah.
And that is just something that does not happen in Western cultures. If you have different beliefs, you are the enemy. You should die.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're like, but respect, you can still respect your enemy, or you can respect, you know, somebody that you disagree with and things like that. And
yeah. And it's the cleanest place I've ever been in my life. There's no garbage anywhere. Absolutely. I walked around the streets of Tokyo at 11 PM with not a care in the world. Mm-hmm. It's the coolest place I've ever been, and I've been to a lot of cool places.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We love to do that. Like 90% of Japan for us is just like walking places, like drink a beer on the street, whatever, just cruise along and like check stuff out because you go from, you know, neighborhood to neighborhood and things change and it'll be a completely urban area and then there's suddenly like a temple that you didn't know was there and it's just like a fascinating place and an amazing
last culture. Time I was there, I was there for a long, because all the BJW tours I was always there for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
One time I was there for 2 days. Yeah. Which was awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was terrible. And then so when I was there for DDT, I was there for like 40 days, so when I had a lot of days off too, like the schedule's much, like the BJW schedule's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
They wrestle a lot in a lot of Italian death matches. So I had a lot of downtime. So I would just get, go down the stairs in my, my hotel. I would turn in a direction and I would just walk.
Yeah. It's all you need to do.
And then I would walk for an hour and I'd be like, oh, okay. Maybe turn around, maybe zigzag across these streets. And I would walk back. I just would pick a different direction every day. And that's, and I wasn't even in 1/10 of Tokyo.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Yeah, there's cool stuff everywhere.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating place. Have you had a chance to, I mean, obviously doing those tours, it probably saw you in certain areas or maybe on a bus, but did you get a chance to do any like regional sightseeing or anything like that? Like in the smaller towns or anything?
One of the tours I did for Big Japan, we did a tour of Hokkaido,
mm-hmm.
In Sapporo. So, and we drove.
Yeah. I'm about to do that. So I've never been to Sapporo before because it's normally covered in ice and snow in the time that we go, but we're going this month and now it's going to be like you can drive places and stuff. I'm hiring a car and like, it's going
to
be.
Yeah, it's like a 20-hour drive.
Yeah, wow.
And then it was crazy from Yokohama to Sapporo.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, it's a big, very big drive. So I got to see a lot of that kind of stuff. But I just was never there long enough, you know?
Yeah.
But I will say the last time I was there, it was more of like hanging out with my friends that like Chris Brooks and, mm-hmm. and Drew, when he was over there, of like hanging out with people that live there and learning about like kind of the real culture and the way people live in Japan, because they actually do. And they're there every day with these people mm-hmm. and you get a sense for how, you know, Japan really is. And even hanging out with the roster members over there, like the DDT people, I like hung out with them, and then Drew and Chris being so fluent in Japanese, it made it so much easier to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of, you know, realize they're just wrestlers, goofballs like everybody else.
It's absolutely.
Yeah, it was very cool. I like that part of it.
Yeah. It's nice when you get to have a peek behind that, because obviously there's, you know, there's all the big tourist stuff and the TikTok locations and all that stuff. But when you get off that beaten map and, like you say, into sort of like the real Japan, and, you know, maybe you're hanging out with a local or, you know, we have a couple of friends there and things like that, and you do get to like really sort of start to see how it really works, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like Shibuya is cool, but like, you know, you don't go there so many times.
Yeah, exactly right. You
say go across, walk across the street.
Yeah. I was actually fortunate enough to go to a bar. I don't know, was a DDT after party or a Big Japan thing? I don't know. Pondo sent me a message and was like, you should come over. And when I went there, Drew and Chris were both there, and Violento Jack and Joe Janela and a bunch of stuff. We were hanging out. Watching those two guys and how fluent they are and like helping us order drinks and, you know, and things like that. It's amazing. Like, I swear I get worse at Japanese with every passing day. Like, and I'm like trying to do it and stuff.
Drew's,
and it's unbelievable.
Drew's so good. Like, he's like fluent. He has the accent down. I've heard Japanese people think that he's half Japanese because he speaks it so well.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris is very, very good too. And I'm terrible. I'm so bad with Japanese names. But I will say, being there for that like 40 days, I did learn a few things. And if you try at all, they are so stoked that you learned any Japanese, because it's just, you're blatantly not Japanese there. Like, there's not very many white people.
Yeah. I've had people like apologize. Like, they're like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, I'm in your country. Like Sayazawa, sweetest man in the world. And he quite often, I actually did an interview with him on this, and he speaks quite good English, but he was a little bit nervous about, you know, being in a podcast medium and not doing that. So I arranged a translator and stuff. His only English interview, by the way. It was not enough people care about that interview. It's actually really makes me upset. But I'm like, this is the coolest thing anyone's ever done. But he... He apologized to me all the time, like, oh, I'm so sorry, my English isn't good. And I'm like, dude, I can't say two words. I can't say two words of Japanese. They're and here like you that. Are, like, conversing with me and, you know, making time for me.
Dude, there's this Masada kid from DDT.
Yes, I know. Like, yeah, I absolutely know who he is.
He's great. Amazing. He's awesome. He's really good.
Mm-hmm.
He was taking me around for, like, 2 days.
Yeah.
And then we get to a show, and Chris was talking to him, and then he just started speaking English. And I was like, the fuck? He was like, oh, what? And I was like, you speak English, dude. I've been trying to talk to you for 2 days. And Chris was like, why didn't you tell him? He's like, I thought maybe my English wasn't good enough. I'm like, you just said that. I was like, your English is fine. Dude. Come on.
You probably speak better English than I do.
Yeah, they're so respectful that they don't even want to attempt, you know, because they don't want to disrespect you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how much it means to them. So, wrestling over there really changed my perspective on wrestling and life. And I'm really grateful that I got to go.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm sure that, not only an amazing experience just even going to that country, but going there on somebody else's dime, being booked to go there, somebody valuing you that much, and then getting to, wrestle in front of those fans and do all that. Amazing.
So funny. Oh, this is my new passport. I was going to say, my old passport's right here. Yeah. My old passport's got all the things, got all the visas.
From that's sick.
From back in the day, it's totally full, because from going to Japan so many times. So I'm so glad that I have that.
What a great souvenir, to just be here's documented proof that this really happened.
Seven times. I went to Japan 7 times.
Man. Yeah. That's so good. that's so good. So at this point, I guess, with all the Japan stuff and that, I guess the natural transition is to lead into 440. And we touched on that at the start, but I know that in that first Japan stuff, you weren't really there. That I was watching independent wrestling and deathmatch stuff pretty actively at this time and getting into GCW. I think the first GCW show that I saw was Two Cups Stuffed, which was the main with Effie and Nick Gage. And I don't think 440 was really a thing, but then those shows started happening at the Voltage Lounge and, Run Ricky Run and all those kind of bits and pieces. How did that first come about, that you were going to form this faction and sort of beef with Nick Gage, who, you admittedly said he was this is one of the first deathmatch wrestlers you saw at CZW and thought was cool,
Yeah. So when I was in CZW, I was one of the only people that never wrestled at the other place. And it was always when's he going? When's he going? When's he going? And everybody always wanted me and Nick. Mm-hmm. And then I wrestled Nick a couple of times at IWA Mid-South while he was champion and while I was CZW champion. Mm-hmm. And, so when the thing came up, I was just I had an idea. I pitched the idea to Ethan Page, and he was call him and tell him, pitch it to him. So I did. Mm-hmm. They said yes, and I pretty much wrote that entire storyline, and which nobody knows, because I don't really talk about it much. Mm-hmm. But that was me. Very collaborative with some of the people, that were a part of it, but for the most part, a lot of that was me. And then the 440 thing just was I actually saw how popular that Schadenfreude was in the UK. I don't know if you know who Schadenfreude
is. I'm not wearing the shirt right now, but I absolutely love them.
Again, of course you have the merch. So they were just the most popular thing in the UK at one point, and they were just merch machines. Just,
yeah.
Hand over fist, their clothing line. Chris Brooks is a genius.
Death by roll up and all that stuff. He just constantly churn it out, doing the drops.
So creative. And I was like, man, when I started wrestling, NWO was awesome.
Yeah.
DX was cool. The Bullet Club 10 years ago was sick, And I was like, I just want to start a faction on the indies and have it be all my friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I ripped off the NWO logo. Obviously, the 440 logo looks exactly like the NWO logo.
Yeah, which is smart because it's like a twist. Wrestling fans love like something when you talk about NWO Bullet Club, although Schadenfreude, all those things. The logo has the same thing in common in that it doesn't look like a wrestling T-shirt. It's not like a picture of HBK with a thing. It's this is a logo that only wrestling fans will know. It looks like a band shirt or something like that. So you can rep it anywhere, but then people give you the nod. People love that.
Dude, it's funny, but when we'd be on the road all the time, we'd all have 440 shirts on. Everybody always thought we were in a band. Always. Oh, you guys in a band? We're like, no. Yeah. But, and I was just trying to think of a way. I wanted to sell merch and wanted my friends to be able to make money off of wrestling because I saw Chris and them do it. Mm-hmm. And all the British people do it. In the UK at the time, that was those guys' jobs.
Yeah, full time.
You know, mm-hmm. they sold merch and wrestled. And it was, I thought it was the coolest thing because it's just not really a viable thing to be able to do in America. I've had a, you know, a job
for the whole time,
most of my career.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So like, I always thought that was so cool. So I was like, well, I'm going to try to listen, man, find out what's successful and then take elements of it and then go like that. I don't understand why people don't do that. So, yeah. But yeah, so I thought of that idea. They went for it and that's the system.
Yeah. And you're like the 440 logo, like being the NWO logo, but in the colors of DX, like, you know, these, like, let's just like all the cool shit. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
100% by design.
Yeah. And 440.
Also, neon green's just like one of my favorite colors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, black and neon green work sick. Is 440 the like Cleveland, like Ohio area code or something like that? I mean, I'm in Australia. So
440 is like where I live, which is outside of Cleveland's. Mm-hmm. Area code, but like a thing in Ohio is that people always say like OH and then other people will yell IO.
Yeah.
So the OH is like for Ohio.
Yeah.
And then I want to put an exclamation point. So it's like they're yelling it.
Yeah.
And then at first, the 4-4, we used to have a dot in between it.
Okay.
Because I wanted it to kind of look, because again, I had that Bullet Club, you know, influence. So I kind of wanted it to look like 44 Magnum, but people say 4-4.
Yes.
For that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like rappers and stuff too.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So I was like, oh, we're 440. Like, and also, remember 303?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I actually love that album because it's like the kind of worst, best kind of white boy rap that I would absolutely
love. Here's the thing. Everybody hated.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, they're going to hate this.
Yeah.
Because it's a bunch of white dudes, white kids from Ohio acting hard like they're gangsters and they're gonna hate this,
which is exactly what 303 are, which is perfect as well. Yeah,
exactly. So we later dropped the little dot because people kept saying 440H and it was getting real annoying.
Yeah, sure.
So we dropped the dot out of there and we even did shirts where we like spelled it out where it said 440.
You're like, how more obvious? So yeah, yeah,
dude. We're so sick of people doing it. Yeah. But yeah, man, that's where it came from, and like I can't believe it worked.
And I mean, it's still working till today. And I mean, yeah, you said, you got your friends like Gregory Iron. You would have first met him Cleveland All Pro, right? Like, wasn't he doing like that JD Lightning vibe?
He trained
there. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yep, absolutely. I met him when Greg was like 18.
Yeah,
something like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just a kid. Same thing. Eric Ryan, he started training at Mega, like, you know, 18, 19 years ago.
Yeah.
Bobby Beverly, I've met him through wrestling around here. That's just, you know, even now, like, you know, Alice Crowley, like I know her from going to IWA Mid-South all the time.
Yeah.
Cause she was always there, Hank, like setting stuff up for Ian Rotten. And then Christian Napier is the Coger brothers' cousin.
Ah, okay. Right. So that's
the actual time. Cousin.
Yeah. Like, right. Right.
Cousin. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 440 is like more than just a wrestling faction.
Yeah. It's all family and friends, like if you all in that
pretty
scene.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. In that, I think one of my favorite 440 moments would have been that fucking chair massacre, or what was that? The Voltage Land, that thing. I do a side show. Like with this guy, his name's Alex from Vinyls and Violence. We do like this show called Anything Goes on this feed where we just kind of talk about wrestling. He was like, I was at that. I threw one of the chairs into the ring. I was like, oh, fuck. It was because I think it was not you. I think it was like Greg and
I wasn't at that
show. And Eric and stuff were there and they just like fucking just got absolutely pummeled with chairs. And I was like, this is the coolest shit I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You're like, I wasn't in it. I don't give a fuck.
I wasn't there.
Now that you say it, I remember. I thought you were at the bottom of the pile, but maybe you went there. Maybe it was the other thing.
And I just remember hearing a story about that and how about it wasn't that cool. So
I'm sure it wasn't for them.
Yeah.
But I think as well, like I remember the other thing I heard on a podcast or whatever was you really fostering that. Like it was what we were talking about at the start. Like, we're going to be this heel faction and we're really going to sell that. The like, when we go in here, everybody, all the fans are going to be coming at us. If you got to fucking push somebody or do whatever, do that shit. And like, you would see that shit on camera. Like,
your guys literally like pushing fans and, you know, fronting fans and things like that because it was getting so hot, you know?
Yeah, it was getting like physical. Like people were like touching us. Yeah. So. Not me so much, which is funny because, you know, I'm way taller than everyone. So I would well push on the other guys. But then, but that's the thing, man. The other guys in 4-4-0 weren't taking shit either.
Yeah.
And I remember it's like a kind of a famous story within our friend group. It was at Run Ricky Run, actually. There was like so many people there. That crowd was crazy. And I remember right before we walked out, like everybody was a bit nervous. And, I just turned to everybody and I was like, hey guys, fuck these motherfuckers.
Sometimes you gotta have that attitude.
and we just walked out, and I remember Greg said that I got him so fired up, and we just walked out and fucking did what we had to do. That was the night that like the garbage riot happened.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Organically.
Yeah.
Organically happened. Organically. Not like that chair riot.
It's not a work, brother. It's that was a shoot.
Yeah. So that was real. That was that's definitely something I'm going to be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Was being able to get people to react like that, especially in a long past a time and era when they know what wrestling is.
Yeah. When it's all like, it may be, and I still think it may be the only time I can think of that happening, like, since the business has been exposed, right? Like, since people have understood it, since people talk about it openly, that it's a thing. Like, I can't think of another time that has had that genuine reaction. Like, real heat is what it felt like.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's happening and everything happens out there, but it was definitely cool to be a part of.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. How was the, the kind of big blow-off match, I guess, of that. You're the champ for ages, and you guys had that big outdoor show. I'm sorry, I forget the name of it, with the scaffolding and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, that felt like
Tampa, that was there.
Yeah, exactly.
RSP Spring Break.
That's what it's like. I should have known that. I should have done my fucking research. I'm an unprofessional motherfucker, but.
Nah, it's okay. I forget sometimes, too. Some of those days I want to forget.
There's a lot, but. How does it feel like? Because essentially, you're now planning for what is the blow off or the end of the biggest rivalry in independent wrestling, you know. And that fucking show was huge, you know. There would be a lot of pressure going into planning something like that, and even like, what can we do to deliver this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I like that stuff. I like that pressure. Yeah. And also, like, I just at that time and recently, I've just been very confident in my abilities to be able to do stuff like that. And I was nervous as hell because there was Mania Weekend always has a certain air to it. And there were people in the locker room from other companies. Mm-hmm. And so it's not only am I like, you know, nervous with the crowd, I'm also nervous on like a professional level.
Yeah.
But I also trust myself and I trust the person I was in there with. Mm-hmm. And at that point I had by force proven that I know what I'm talking about when it comes to putting these kinds of matches together, these storylines, these angles, these run-ins. And I was given the proper time and clearance to do what I wanted.
Yeah, sure.
So, again, by force. Mm-hmm. And so I was ready.
Yeah.
I was so ready for that. And I really liked that match. I really, like, think I did something very cool that day. Mm-hmm. And also, like, the fact that that wasn't a blow-off and we ended up going a little bit further than doing War Games, that was very cool for me because everybody just assumed that was it.
Yeah.
And they don't remember the little, you know, where I turned babyface for a little bit and went down to the lower levels, then turned again and got like, anyways, again, all stuff that I booked. So yeah, I was ready for that. And, it was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so where are we today then? Because after that all happens, obviously we've got the split and stuff, and I know that you sort of publicly announced you were stepping away from death matches, though did I see you maybe going to dabble with it? I don't remember. So just kind of update me where we're sort of sitting today, because Koga sort of takes over 440 and you kind of step away for a bit, right, and then roll back into it.
I did step away because it was too much. Sure. For me for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like doing it anymore. Mm. And to be honest, I still kind of don't want to do it.
Yeah.
But I love it so much. And I think that I owe Deathmatch Wrestling a few more and doing what I want to be able to presented the way I think it should be, not the way it is nowadays, because I definitely think the style has become bastardized and boring and lazy. So I want to come back and show people how to do it the right way.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just get that little itch, you know, because I think people forget that I was a bad motherfucker. you know,
surely so, not. I mean, you can only bleed so much before people remember forever, right? That's how it works in wrestling.
So, I think sometimes people forget. So sometimes I feel like I have to remind them. You know, I did a little bit at MLW. I dabbled a little bit little deathmatch stuff there, but I would never. I'm never going to go back full time. I'll probably never do another tournament. And I'm just right now. It's just people that I want to work.
Yeah.
And that I think I can have a good match with and tell a good story and remind people how good deathmatch wrestling can be.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I kind of know what you're saying as well. There's definitely been, and I've seen some tournaments and stuff recently where I'm like, was this really a deathmatch tournament? Like by the end of it, because I'm like, not that much sort of happened. And I'm not kind of the person that's like, I want to see blood, but I want to see a spectacle. You know what I mean? I want to have that feeling that I had when I first saw it in Big Japan. You know, I want to be shook. Like,
it's just because people are lazy and they give everybody, it's the same stuff. Light tube exchange, headbutt with a gusset, fucking bar fight. Like, it's the same spots over and over and over and over and over again. Like, everybody is lazy or just plain sucks. I mean, I hate to say that.
Yeah.
I hate to be like that negative about it, but it's gotten to a point where it's just like, come on. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, half the reason I want to do these little shows that I'm starting to do with Clash in Michigan, because I want to show people how cool and epic and how awesome
visceral
Deathmatch Wrestling
can be. I think is a great
just
word.
How like you can get so invested, like, you know, the way I used to feel watching FMW was just, it felt bigger than life.
Yeah. Since we've been doing these shows in bars here and stuff like that, I've had friends coming to wrestling shows to see this stuff. And these are people who don't watch wrestling, but they'll fucking come and see that. You know what I mean? They're like, this is the best time. This is crazy what's happening here. And they're like buying tickets to shows. I'm going to be away for the next show. They're all still going because they love to see it. You know, they're asking me about deathmatch wrestlers and shit because it is like this amazing spectacle. And if you're not delivering that or people aren't feeling that, then what is deathmatch, you know?
Yeah, it's nothing. You're just doing it to do it.
Absolutely.
Like a grinder.
Yeah. And you know, you need to put something in. Like, it's like, are we just going through the motions or is this going to tell the story of a war, you know?
And also, where else do we go? You just do everything all the time, the same stuff. Like, you dial back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, not every match has to have light tubes. Like, it's insane.
Also, they kind of stopped making them. We've got to be careful with them.
They're little light tube meters.
Yeah, it's dropping down. A match like that I think of, I did, this is before I ever did an interview, I did an episode called Thank You, Tremont, and it was me just talking about the match that you had with Matt when he was retiring. At H2O, you know, with the scaffolding and things like that. And that, to me, is still one of the best deathmatch stories I've seen, like, in just a match, you know, because you guys told the whole story of, like, your friendship and Grant and everything like that. And you don't see that shit very often.
Yeah, and also like right when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, not too long after. So it was
emotionally infused.
Yeah, it was very emotional. And, you know, even just like grieving and going through that and like talking to Grant's family and stuff like that and realizing that we were closer than I even knew. Yeah. And so it was really hard to do that. And I just let it out in that match. Mm. And I think it showed.
Absolutely.
And Matt, you know, Matt's one of the best ever. So he was right there with me. And, one thing I always heard Matt, he would brag about is that match. He only did one move.
Only did one move. Yeah.
He only did one move. He did a Samoan drop. That was it.
Yeah.
Go back and think about it. He did not do a single move. I beat his ass for 30 minutes.
Yeah. It really was. I'm just thinking, he gets thrown to the ropes and everything like that. You throw him off the scaffold. Yeah. He did fucking nothing. He just gets his ass kicked for like the entire time.
Yep.
And loses, right? And even loses, like at the end.
Loses.
But that one Samoan drop or whatever, the plate explodes.
Sure did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was just, you know, another. I think my career in the later years is just proving points, man, and trying to show kids the right way to do it. Even if you won't listen, you won't listen now. One day you'll go back and you'll watch, and you'll be like, man. Okay.
This motherfucker knew what he's talking about.
Yeah, I get it now. I get it now. Like, you know, and I hope that I help somebody because I want wrestling to be around forever and I want it to be cool.
Yeah.
And if I got to be, you know, you were talking about me having kind of that reputation and I kind of have that reputation in the back.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've been called difficult before, and that's because I ain't taking no shit. Mm-hmm. And I ain't gonna let anybody else take any shit either, because mm-hmm. People get taken advantage of in all facets of life. But it happens in wrestling quite a bit, mm-hmm. and so I'm just not gonna do it.
Yeah,
and I hope that kids see me doing that as well, and they stick up for themselves.
Yeah, that's awesome. If we speak as we start to wind up, I don't want to take up your entire night, but I do want to touch on. Like Atticus and 440 and stuff, because I know you played a part in his training from when he was really young, and then, you know, you step away from 440 and he's sort of like the natural leader. How's it feel to see how far he's come? Because he's another just fucking amazing wrestler. I would say he probably had my favorite final in a tournament in the, was it Tournament of Survival 666, him and Cologne. I thought was amazing, and he worked so hard in that match. Like, I just think the world of him as like a wrestler. It must be pretty amazing to see a guy that, you know, you've known for so long just come so far.
Yeah. I mean, you know, given our take away our current situation.
Well, let's not talk about that. We're just divorcing ourselves from any current beef. Yeah.
You know, because that's a touchy subject.
Yeah, sure.
I wish he would just listen more, but
is that your whole relationship with him always?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Always has been.
Yeah.
That's kind of our dynamic. I'm glad to see him doing what he's doing, mm-hmm. how he's doing it his way, because that's how I did it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see him not in trouble, mm-hmm. because if I didn't step in, I think he would not be having the life that he has today. And I think sometimes he should remember that.
That is fair. Enough said. Now tell me about the Clash show we've got coming up, because you're doing a bit of promoting. You've got stuff going on. What's yes. going on? What are we doing?
Yeah. Clash Wrestling came to me, wanted to help me with some hardcore stuff. I was going to be doing my own deathmatch tournament this year, which I announced earlier this year, but life happened and things got pushed back.
Sure.
And this was actually the date of the tournament that we were going to do. But again, just things got pushed back. That happens. It's wrestling.
Yeah.
So Clash, they were like, they came to me and was like, hey, we want to help you do your tournament, blah, blah, blah. And then we came up with an idea where we're like, okay, let's run a limited series of hardcore wrestling shows. Mm-hmm. leading up to this tournament in either later this year or beginning of next year. And we'll kind of build up because Clash is a very family oriented promotion.
Sure.
Very much a family entertainment kind of place. So this is definitely out of their wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And we really want to make sure that people know that about, you know, if you're a fan of Clash Wrestling, we want you to come bring the kids. It's not going to be crazy. Mm-hmm. I promise. It's not going to be crazy, but parental guidance is strongly advised. But again, it's not going to be like all these other deathmatch shows. It's not going to be complete carnage the entire time.
Yeah.
I'm slowly transitioning to, I guess, a backstage role, mm-hmm. Which I love. I love doing that. I started running some small student shows here in Ohio as well. And I just recently helped out with a wrestling supercard. Yes, I helped put together in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And I also am working a bit backstage with Burning Heart Pro Wrestling out of the UK. Mm-hmm. So this was just a natural fit. And Michigan does not have an athletic commission as tight as Ohio's. And so you are able to do the kind of wrestling there. And I wanted to do it. And I fucking love old school IWA Mid-South. That's why the show is named Simply the Best.
Yeah.
IWA Mid-South used to have a show called Simply the Best. Mm-hmm. And I just want to book some hardcore wrestling, but also some good wrestling. I'm telling everybody it's ECW mixed with old school CZW, little 2003 Ring of Honor, and some Big Japan.
There you go. What a mix.
That's kind of where my head is.
Yeah.
So hardcore wrestling with some deathmatch wrestling elements.
Yeah.
And story and build and epic. I just want it to feel cool.
Yeah.
Because I'm excited about it. Mm-hmm. I think the wrestlers are excited about it. Mm-hmm. Everybody's hitting me up, talking to me about how cool everything is, even the graphics. Like, people are talking about how cool the graphics are, which is very happy because that's, you know, that's a thing in itself. You don't have cool graphics.
It's half the battle, you know, getting anybody yeah,
really
to look
is.
At it.
So shout out to JR, graphic designer who did it. Like, he's killing it. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, man, I just want to do cool stuff with cool people. Mm-hmm. And I watched a Rick Rubin interview, and he was talking about how he just makes stuff that he likes and he hopes other people like it too. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the philosophy I'm under right now, is like, even with the 440 stuff, like, mm-hmm. we do a lot of outside of the box ideas. Even though promo we dropped today, it's just like basically a music video of us hanging out.
Yeah.
But there's storyline implications in that video. You have to watch the stuff. Mm-hmm. And because I'm just trying to think outside the box, and I want to have people be invested other than just two guys on a flyer, what kind of meat's going to be hanging off their body afterward. And then when that guy gets chewed up and spit out, you find the next guy. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I want to do cool, compelling storytelling, hardcore fucking deathmatch shit that I loved. Listen, love the wife beater. Who doesn't? Give me Lobo all day.
Yeah.
But you know what? I love Nick Mondo. I love Homicide, who can wrestle and do death matches. I don't know who's on the show. Mm-hmm. You know, guys like that. That's who I like. So that's what I'm going for.
That's great.
And I'm really, really excited.
Yeah. So would you say that this first show, like, this is like the jumping on point, right? Like, I grew up being a comic book guy, you know, I'm always looking for a series. I want a starting point. So if somebody hasn't seen Clash before and they want to see what you're about and what you're going to do, this is the perfect place to like jump in episode one and then follow it, because this is where the stories and this new kind of arc begins.
Yes, absolutely. And also, if you are a fan of Clash, you will see some of your favorites of Clash. I tried to book a bunch of them for this show and a bunch of them weren't available. I feel so bad about it.
Yeah.
Because now it just looks like Ricky and his friends.
Yeah.
But I promise you, I tried to book a bunch of people. They just weren't available. There's a bunch of guys and girls at Clash that I absolutely love, mm-hmm. that I wanted on the show. I hit up Ren Jones. He wasn't available. I hit up AK. Allison Kay, she wasn't available. I wanted to book Juntai. He wasn't available. There was a guys that I really like from Clash, mm-hmm. that weren't there. So I tried.
Hey, it's wrestling. Yeah, people come and go all the time. So, you know, it'll work out. They'll come back.
People around. Who come to Clash to be able to come to the show and still kind of see what's going on. And then I want anybody who's jumping on who likes hardcore wrestling, deathmatch wrestling, and that wants something a little bit more with a little bit more substance. It's not going to be a soap opera. It's not going to be crazy, but there'll be some, trust me.
Yeah.
There'll be some stuff.
It's just Ricky Shane Page we're talking about here.
I want to build to stuff. There'll be storylines. Listen, half of 440 is on the show. Mm-hmm. you can't get us in the same locker room. It just, stuff happens. So something's going to happen. And that's all I want to do. And I want to give people a reason to come back. Mm-hmm. And I want to, Clash does a lot of good things. And he's a very, Jeremy Jones, who runs Clash, is a very, very good dude, mm-hmm. who is just, his main goal is that he told me he just wants wrestling to be better in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I have the same sentiment about home, about Cleveland.
Yeah.
And that's all. And in my philosophy in life right now is I only fuck with people who have good intentions.
Mm-hmm. Keep that positive.
That's all I need in life. All I need is good intentions, man. You can take over the world with good intentions and three good friends. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
You did it. Once before.
So it's, that's the kind of people I want to work with, you know, passionate people. And Jeremy and Clash are passionate people. And I'm hoping that this drives more business to their more family-friendly oriented shows too. So there's just more places for wrestlers to work, more places, more opportunities. And I just want to keep wrestling alive for as long as I can. Yeah. You know, I do. I just love it. And I'm very creative and I love producing and writing wrestling. So I'm really excited about this. And I'm still performing. I'm still getting in there and I'm going to get in there and get a little crazy at this one. The main event will be announced shortly.
Hell yeah. That's awesome. Also, you were kind enough to put the show on my birthday, which was really thoughtful. We hadn't met yet, but it was a great date. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris told me when your birthday was.
Oh, yeah. Nice of him. Shout out Chris Kohlenberg.
He's
a real good friend of mine. He's obviously teed this all up. So that's a great surprise. Or will there be a way to watch this live or watch this recorded it's going down?
The show will stream live on IWTV.
Oh, great. Okay, then. Well, I will and watch it while I'm in Japan.
Okay. And also, I've been told, I'm working out the details, that there may be a pay-per-view option where you don't have to be a subscriber.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
You can just pay for the event.
That's a really cool feature.
Being a subscriber, IWTV is awesome. Wrestling Open is worth the price of the subscription itself. Mm-hmm. If you ask me, it's the future of wrestling. Everybody will be able to watch. And again, it's a stream, so there's going to be videos. I'm known for my promos. There's going to be stuff on the stream. I'm going to try to do it. Listen, I'm under a time crunch as always, but I work good under pressure. But I'm going to do the best I can to put on a real kick-ass show.
That's awesome. Well, tell everybody where they need to go beyond IWTV. Are there some handles they need to follow on Twitter and Instagram and stuff to follow Clash and follow yourself?
Sure. At Clash Wrestling on everything, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, clashwrestling.net for tickets. Tickets are on sale now. Mm-hmm. I just announced a match earlier, Jessica Havoc versus Alice Crowley in a doorway to heaven, just a bunch of doors. What else did I announce? Oh, the 6-way ladder match with Mark Wheeler, Crash Jackson, Jake Crist, Christian Napier. Oh, God. There's two more people. Ashton, I don't remember. There's other people.
This is off the top of the head here, people. Read the poster. Like,
yeah, I've been talking for 2 hours. Anyways, there's just matches that are announced. Like I said, there's more to come. And at Ricky Shane Page on everything, at the 440, if you want to catch up on all of the 440 happenings, we've been putting out these Your Move videos. We just put out another video today called Yams, which is quite fun if you want to go check that out. Follow us on YouTube as well. Clash Wrestling is really where the main stuff will be. In any of my socials, you'll see all the stuff for Simply the Best. I'm really excited about the show, and I've got some really good friends coming. Oh, Homicide versus Vincent Nothing. That's
sick. What a match.
Can't wait for that one. Guys like Homicide are coming in, and people that I really highly respect and that are very good friends of mine. And I think we're going to put on a really good show that everybody's going to really, really like. Mm-hmm. And I just want to have fun. And I want as many people to be able to have fun with me in that building or live on the stream that day. And I hope people tune in.
Absolutely. I for one can't wait for it. I think your taste and what you want and the things you like and everything just scratches the itch of everything that I like in wrestling. So I think this is going to be tailor-made for fans like me. And so, yeah, I really can't wait to see it, man. And I wanted to take a quick minute again just to thank you for your time today. It's been so great to get to know you, to just run through your journey and to give everybody a peek in. So they need to check out that show.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate you letting me come on and promote. And this was a breeze. It did not drag at all, which is surprising because, again, I don't like doing podcasts.
Yeah.
But this was great. Wonderful talk. I really appreciate it.
Oh, that is amazing. Well, thank you so much. So everybody out there, make sure you check out Clash. Check out everything Ricky is doing. And remember, it's all about peace, love, and pro wrestling. Thanks for listening. Faces and Feels is a proud member of the Countout Podcasting Network. It is created and hosted by me, Rafe Houston, edited by myself and the amazing Ryan Neitzy, and the show is available on all good podcast platforms, so please go rate and subscribe. You can follow the show everywhere on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, etc. at Faces Feels Cast, and you can check out the Countout Network and all our sister shows over there at Countout Pod. If you'd like to book me for commentary, have an interview request, a topic suggestion, or you just want to say hi, you can email us at facesandfeels@gmail.com. With all that said, thanks for listening, and please support our friends and sponsors. Peace.
My body is a roadmap of pain.
DeathmatchWorldwide.com, the official online merchandise store that is only for Deathmatch Wrestling. Featuring official t-shirts from No Peace Underground, John Wayne Murdoch, Akira, Madman Pondo, Zona 23, Neil Diamond Cutter, G Raver, Schlack, Necro Butcher, and many more. If you are a deathmatch wrestler, promotion, manager, or platform, and are interested in joining the web store, send us an email to deathmatchworldwide@yahoo.com. Deathmatchworldwide.com for the final view.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This has been a Countout Podcast.
Hey, have you guys heard of the new show on the Countout Network, the Ichiban Sweetcast?
It's the brand new Japan Pro Wrestling podcast starring the International Wrestling Grand Prix. That's me, your good friend Curtis Spears.
And me, your bad friend Rafe Houston. And we're here to talk about everything New Japan Pro Wrestling, reacting to everything, getting worked up, getting very happy, sometimes crying. Kind of like something else we used to do, right?
Oh, yeah. That was the old Okada Shorts podcast, right?
Ah, that's right. And if you love that show, you're going to love this show because it's exactly the same show.
Yeah, we just had to change the name.
Yeah, we did. But you can check it everywhere on a social media handle that we haven't made yet.
Yeah, we're really new to this. So what you can do is search on your favorite podcast catcher of choice. Look for the Ichiban Sweetcast.
Sweetcast, Ichiban.